From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys, another true crime edition. This is a true crime Cowboys, right? I'm Hunter in Dallas, and joining me in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado is Mr. John Gray. Say hello, John.
Hello.
And in the wild outback of Australia, we have Mr. Stuart Balk. Say hello, Stu.
Oh, hello. I'm just got my sketchbook out.
Yeah.
Oh, God. There's this really cute-looking guy over the road. I've got my eye on you. You hear me? Your damn shorts and your shirtless. Hello. Yeah.
I'm going to be crucified.
Joining us for the first time, very excited. This is I've never actually talked to this man, but I've known him on the internet for so long. He's like a regular fixture in my life. You know, it feels like he's a close friend, but I've never actually spoken to him. It's Dan. Say hello, Dan.
Hi. We are friends.
We are friends.
I guess. Yeah.
And returning to the show, we have Gian Quasar. Say hello, Gian.
How are you doing?
And we'll just so we don't confuse you and John Grace, we'll call you Quasar or Quester.
Q.
Q.
Q-Man.
The Q-Man.
Yeah, the Q-Man works.
Q-Man. This episode was suggested by John, and honestly, you know, this is one where I'm going to kind of step back a little bit because you suggested this, but I went down a rabbit hole with this thing. So, John Grace, what is this show about?
Tonight we're going to look at the case of the Doodler, who was
the Diddler,
the Doodler,
the Butcher, the Baker, the Doodler.
Yeah, no, this is the worst serial killer name of all time.
Dirk Diggler,
but,
the Diggler.
The Doodlers. Exactly. The Doodlers sounds like those fast punk pop bands in the late 90s, like Blink-182, the Doodlers.
Yeah, it's or Pansy Division or something. But
oh, that was Joy Division.
No, there was actually a pop punk band called Pansy Division.
Oh, really?
I did not know that. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Was that learn something new every day.
That was the Village People's Renaissance album, wasn't it?
Man, you are really pushing for that Can't Stop the Music show. We're going to have to do
that. Oh, I am, and it doesn't matter, because I just got for Father's Day, which was yesterday, the Village People box set of their entire recordings on CD.
So, oh, my gosh.
He's not joking.
No, I know
he's
not.
I'm
no,
not actually
no,
not joking.
Not.
No.
Yeah.
Do they still make CDs?
Strangely,
well, you can't
they
play
do.
Vinyl in your car, so they have to
can't
make
play
it.
Vinyl in my car, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the anyway, this Doodler character, it's been getting some web attention that there was these killings in the 70s, and it sounds like a movie like William Friedkin's Cruising.
It definitely. I was thinking about Cruising when I was
right, and I think there's a misconception that it inspired that movie. That's already starting to be memed around. I think I've only seen in the mainstream like Yahoo News. Like publish a story, but which is really nothing. But I suspect this will be the next big thing because it's very weird and unique and almost movie-like.
And why, John? Where did this take place?
San Francisco, 1970s.
So like San Francisco it's the serial killer capital of the world at this time.
Yeah, practically. This is at the height of like when Harvey Milk was in office and what people now know about San Francisco through movies. This was going on allegedly.
John. They should have just banned the sale of Twinkies in San Francisco in the '70s because it was doing a lot of damage.
Wasn't going to do anything. But anyway,
damn sugar man.
The Q man on his website has been writing a pretty interesting analysis of this case, and I'll turn it over to him to let him give his sort of introduction to everything, because he's pretty good at describing this sort of thing in his unique Boris Karloff type of way. So wait, take it away, Q man.
What does Boris Karloff mean?
Well, if you've ever heard his wonderful radio programs.
Where the Grinch?
Yeah, yeah. But he used to do like Edgar Allan Poe narrations, and he would host the TV show Thriller. And, you know, this is after his movie career was kind of down to the B movies and everything.
So, Q, when you finish what you're about to say, you have to finish it with Quote of the Reef and Nevermore.
Yeah.
Right? I thought that was Vincent Price.
Well, Boris Karloff did it as well in The Raven in 63. I think it was it Karloff or was it Price?
Well, Karloff
was... No, it was Price. In the Raven, the movie, it was Price.
Oh, shit. All this time I thought it was Karloff. Okay,
there was a Raven movie in the 30s, wasn't there?
No, this is the one in the 60s I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
Well, there you go.
The Roger Corman one.
You have to do it like, Quoth the Raven, Nevermore. Hello, I'm Vincent Price.
Yes. It's a pretty good impression there, Hunter.
That's really good.
The House of Wax is actually just a bondage parlor in real life.
Yes, hello. Man, come see my House of Wax.
Yeah, WHACKS.
All right, so Q-Man, tell us about your writings.
My ruminations. Well, right now they're only synopses for what will be going on the Questor files. It'll be a big display like I did with the EARONS. You know what all that was about with all the videos of the crime scenes and the pictures. And I'll be quoting from the coroner reports and whatever I can come up with. In any case, to encapsulate this, there were some murders in 1974. Let's start out rather ignorant like everybody else was at the time because these didn't get much news attention. There were a few murders in 1974. From the circumstances, SFPD could deduce that they were homosexual murders because of the viciousness of the knifing, and that was their philosophy at the time, that these tended to be very vicious murders. There was one in January at Ocean Beach, one in Tenderloin, which is the actual district in San Francisco.
Was Tenderloin the name of the district or a bar?
No, the Tenderloin was the district.
Oh, okay.
Is the district to this day. And so a guy, the one at Ocean Beach was Gerald Cavanaugh. He was 49 years old. He was knifed January 27, I believe, 1974, early February. Stig Berlin is knifed in his apartment in Tenderloin. Then come June 24, a high-end drag performer, Jay Stevens, is knifed at Golden Gate Park. I think July 7, a Swedish immigrant who was staying with friends.
I thought he was German.
No, Klaus Christmann, he was Swedish.
Oh, okay.
I do believe so. Maybe he was German, I'm not sure. But in any case, he was killed with a knife at Ocean Beach as well, so far removed from the last victim. And that's pretty much it for 1974. Didn't rate much. 1975, a glut of murders begins, but they're not being reported except in gay newspapers. In other words, the Bay Area Reporter or the Sentinel. And this starts with cross-dressers in Tenderloin. Three were Spanish. And then this branches out in May. There is a community meeting. People realize something's going on here. And then in May, of another vicious murder. This is south of Market, which is Tenderloin is north of Market. South of Market is the district south of Market. And it was known for the leather bars, for the bondage parlors, for the real heavy duty Sado stuff. And this guy's in real Jack the Ripper type of style. He leaves the Brig, which is one of the big bars. He's later found in Door Alley, strangled and then mutilated. You can imagine where. And this is late at night, so his body is found later. And this would have been in August, in between, in July, Dennis Dickinson is knifed up, also on Folsom, which is south of Market. So these are three south of Market killings. During this time in July, a couple of guys at Market and Van Ness are attacked in Fox Plaza. Both survive. One is a Swedish diplomat. The other one is a prominent citizen. Shortly around this time, a nationally known entertainer is also attacked to an extent. Each describes a black man who wore a navy watch cap, and he doodled at the, it was Burke's truck stop where the first one met with him. The second one apparently connected with him at Nick's on Market. And I don't know where the nationally known entertainer connected, but he doodled pictures of people in the bars or the restaurants, or he doodled pictures of them or of other type of representations. And so perhaps there was also a solicitation for cocaine. And he went with two of them, of course, to Fox Plaza, and that's where he knifed the diplomat six times in the back, saying, "You guys are all alike." He came out of the bathroom, came right up to his back, said, "You guys are all alike," and knifed him. The diplomat did survive.
I heard the knife broke off and was like stuck in his lung or something.
That's possible. I do believe it was broken. Then a very gruesome murder in Sado occurred once again at Fox Plaza, which another investigator has informed me about recently, and that would be George Gilbert. And he was killed there September 29. And things are getting out of hand. The the gay community, you know, these aren't hate crimes. This was a guy stalking, specifically one or more persons stalking and killing in very gruesome fashions gay men at night. And then it really goes over the edge in December when Claude Demotte is killed in his Turk Street apartment. He was sometimes a cross-dresser. He was killed in very vicious ways. He was emasculated, mutilated. His anus was cored. He was bludgeoned to death and found in bed with the sheet pulled up over his head. He was bludgeoned with the lamp. In January, it's a similar type of murder up Turk Street. And Bruce DeJohn was also killed and bludgeoned to death. And so
excuse me, what year are we in now?
In January 1976.
Okay.
Jeez.
So all said and done, what really got reported here was only a small section, a small strata of the victims. And these were in the, basically in the case of Dave Toski, and five names are released to the public. In January, the doodler takes form. They get the sketch of this young black man who was sketching pictures. And the three who survived said, you know, basically it was the Swedish diplomat that did the most work with the sketch.
Yeah.
And so these names are released, and they're Gerald Kavanaugh as one of the victims, and that's January 74. Jay Stevens in June 1974. Klaus Christman, July 1974. We skip ahead to May 1975 to Fred Capin, who was also knifed at Ocean Beach near where Kavanaugh was. And then for whatever reason, Harold Goldberg, a 66-year-old Swedish sailor who lived on 6th Street and was found dead in early June 1975 at Land's End, which is the park by the Lincoln Heights Golf Club up there. These five names are released as potential victims of the doodler. And then he's connected to potentially 14 others. These 14 others, their names are not released. This is how it cycles in the number of San Francisco Chronicle or Examiner news articles that are released thereafter, which is not very many. And it just never really took hold with the public. It's rather, I've never seen such, you know, nebulousness in any bureau attempting to promulgate the idea of serial killer is afoot. I've seen the coroner reports, and frankly, Harold Goldberg, the coroner, didn't even know if he was murdered or not. It was accident versus homicide undetermined, and he certainly wasn't knifed. So it's this cascades more, which we don't have to go into now, but why these names were ever released and why so many of the other names were not connected. But the doodler kind of takes form as a young black guy who is hunting gay men at night in this very raucous part of town. This was a very carnival time. It was a boom town for gay culture in San Francisco. And all these guys were at bars or thereabouts. And so it kind of comes out a little later that a shrink turns in after the sketch is released to the public and the whole idea of a doodler is born. A shrink in the East Bay turns in one of his patients, saying that during sessions, this guy, who looks very much like the police sketch, said he confessed to doing the Ocean Beach murders. And these were, of course, three of the five that were released to the news. These the names I went over with you.
Right.
And it wasn't, I don't know how much devotion was really given to this at the time. Apparently, they thought his name was Dr. Priest, like a priest, a religious priest.
Yeah.
Now, today, they think it might be Dr. Priest, P-R-E-E-C-E. Apparently, it was just a phone call that was itself doodled down, and there wasn't much follow-up, but we get the idea that we have a frustrated latent homosexual or something who was going out killing gays, and then he, after the police spoke with him, supposedly, he got nervous that he was identified, and he stopped. He skipped town, supposedly, to New Orleans. Much later, came back, and, you know, it's not like this really got around much. There were just a few newspaper reports. And about 30 years later, the case is slowly being reborn. I started writing about it 6 years ago. There was a couple of articles, one in The Owl, which was very interesting. San Francisco Chronicle has done a couple.
Yeah. The reporter with the Chronicle, he did a podcast about it.
Mm-hmm.
Fagan? It's like, yeah, Kevin Fagan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically Fagan, and it's stuff that regurgitates these five. And I just cannot handle why this becomes a narrative and that's all they repeat. They don't investigate.
No, and definitely getting one of my pet peeves is innocence activism. And I really am seeing them laying the groundwork for that with this.
Can you describe what that is? Innocence activism.
It's like on a documentary on Netflix or making a murderer. The Central Park Five really didn't do it. It was a racist cop who framed them. All of this kind of thing, and I can see them laying. This is just a hunch. I may be completely wrong, but I can see them laying the groundwork. There was a recent article in the Chronicle where they're talking about how this Dr. Priest may have been an ex-gay, you know, one of these ex-gay therapy people. And that, so this guy was a victim of this religious, the ex-gay treatment. What do they call it?
Conversion therapy.
Yeah. And so they're starting to lay the groundwork of this poor killer. You know, and I hate that because it should be about justice for the victims. And I can't stand this kind of phony baloney stuff. And I can see that starting to happen. And I'm a little concerned about that. And the other thing I'm concerned about is I can see careers, people, dollar signs and opportunity signs are lighting up in their heads. And they're like, wow, I could get a documentary out of this. I could get a podcast out of this. Mm-hmm. And it's like the next new thing. And we've seen that happen before. I know Mr. Q has had that experience before with the Eron's case. I'm just kind of leery of all of it right now.
Well, what needs to happen is a comedian needs to have a wife who's writing a book on it. And he needs to kill her.
So-called comedian, please. So-called comedian.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I've Patton Oswalt has never made me laugh. So, by the way, did you guys see on Twitter? Somebody posted a. I know you didn't, Stu. Somebody posted a picture of them holding up "I'll Be Gone in the Dark," and it said like, "Hey, you know, at Patton Oswalt, just wanted to buy this book at this local bookstore to promote local businesses."
Oh, and God!
John, just wait. This is brilliant. You know how on Twitter you click the picture and it expands, and so. He tagged Patton Oswalt. Patton retweeted it. And then you click on the picture and it expands and it says Patton killed his wife.
Oh, shit.
It's brilliant.
Oh, hilarious.
But yeah, Dan, I think you're really onto something there because that's a pet peeve of mine as well is you know, you there's this genre of true crime. I think it started with the Thin Red Line. I mean, the blue line.
Well, I can see them fitting it into the current gay political narrative. You know, right. I mean, is Chick-fil-A going to be involved? is Mike Pence going to be involved?
Right.
You know, and I'm an independent. I have no dog in any race. But I mean, it's like I don't like the kind of narrative stuff. I want the truth. And I was telling Mr. Q earlier that, you know, crime is messy. Crime doesn't fit into your perfect little storyline. You know, there's going to be things about it that are going to disturb you. It always does. So.
And there's always, know. Like you said, the political agenda. I remember Netflix put out this documentary on Jeffrey Epstein and they just constantly were hitting any connection to Donald Trump. Just any connection to Trump. Yeah. No mention of the Clintons. There were, of course, but there's no mention of anyone on the left. Yeah. You know, so it's,
and that's part of the problem is that everybody just focuses on the opposite side.
Right, so right, exactly.
You don't get the truth about anything. It's just cheap political points, you know.
Precisely.
Never let delirium get in the way of the truth.
Anyway.
That was being tried back then.
Mm. Yeah.
You should see the two sides that if you read the Bay Area Reporter, which I was reading through all the issues and then Sentinel and so forth, the extent that some were using this, that they would balk against poor Dianne Feinstein. She put her foot in it several times, blaming the sadomasochist crowd, and SFPD backed her up. And then the gay newspapers and the activists would crucify her for that. But at the same time, you'd see letters to the editors and then other news articles being written saying, you know, obviously there's a couple of, you know, real sicko gay guys in the sadomasochist crowd that are going around and doing this. It was obvious these were not hate crimes. These were victims who were carefully stalked by someone who was meeting them at the bar, was part of an escort service. And it's quite obvious that it was being used for politics, though.
It's because the victims were all had the handkerchief in the wrong position. And you don't do that in the gay community.
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the, Q-Man, that's the narrative I kind of get from Fagan's work, is that this is a hate crime.
Yeah, that's totally false.
Yeah.
I've now studied over 30 of these murders. They start earlier in the 1970s. They continue in the mid-80s. There's a second big wave in late 80 through 81 of very similar crimes. In between, there were the clone murders in which everybody was certain David Likens was responsible.
This
he was arrested
insane.
For them, and then he was hung. He hung himself. Jeez. And all this was...
Tell them about the clone murders.
The clone murders, well...
Sounds like a Star Wars
these,
film.
After it's published in the BAR that the Tenderloin crowd knows who this is, they're going to go get him themselves and act vigilante. The murders do stop in Tenderloin. It takes several months before they begin in April 1976 elsewhere. And they're clearly quite vicious and done in Sado, a couple of them. Those are the murders of John Marsala and Grant Daly. But in 78, another phenomenon hits after 77 is basically a lull in these similar type of murders. They begin again. And of course, now they're far from San Francisco. The victims were last seen south of Market in one of the leather bars or in the Castro, which was now becoming the center. Nightlife was moving west to the Castro, which is another district by Buena Vista Park. And the victims were being found at Tunitas Creek Road, which is in San Mateo County. And this is quite a distance from San Francisco. This is right on the coast by Highway 1. This is where the leather biker gangs would meet to do their day rides together, I later discovered from advertisements in the old newspaper. So again, we see a leather connection from south of Market, if not for the fact that the victims were last seen there. So we get four names out of this. They were strangled in Sado. There was other stuff done to them. The bodies were then dumped off the side of the road. Two are still John Doe's, I believe. One, Jerry Haberly, was dumped in Marin. So A. Tomlin Goodman III was dumped along with Daniel J. Aller and Robert Ronald Young off Tunitas Creek Road. And it was, this continued from March when they were first being found, 1978, to September 16, 1978. And these are the ones that are found. shortly thereafter, someone who was very popular within the gay community, David Likens, who was a bartender at the Pines, a waiter here and there. He was in the model shows. He did a couple of porno movies. He was called the Robert Redford of gay porn. And that's serious. That's in the BAR in a news, in a review.
Very good looking. Blonde.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he's arrested for it. He had a previous conviction of where he strangled a guy in L.A. and carved up his chest. And, you know, this was strangling and mutilation. And this fit a lot of that was going on, even a couple of those 1976 murders and the late 1975 ones. So Likens knows he's got a bad record already. And he hangs himself in January 1979 in a Richmond jail. A few months later, his roommate, Danny Hepburn, gets rid of himself too. Supposedly he does. I don't know if it was vigilantes getting even. I don't have the details. But his name becomes anathema to the gay community because they're convinced he was the one who was not only killing these clones, but then they're called the clone murders, by the way, because all these guys look very similar. They were the boy next door, clean cut looking guy, which was a pretty rarity for anybody in the 1970s.
Everyone he killed looked alike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so disturbing.
Yeah, and is that Likens? I don't know. He may be one of these I talked about earlier. Could have been his getting away with it. There was another guy who was a victim of Likens and his buddy Bob, and he came public about it in 1980, and there's a long article in the Bay Area Reporter on him talking about how he barely survived, and Likens told him, I guess it's just a weak spot on me that I felt sorry for you, kind of like, you know, he was going to be another victim. And so the community is sure that it was their poster child is now this killer. But you see similar type of murders continued even after Likens hung himself. So how many was he responsible for?
Right.
I have to dig into that now. And again, this is where, you know, the community was certain. Let's see, with the 14 names plus the five, I would say four, remove Goldberg, and then add the eight clones and a few others that people haven't heard about. And we're talking close to 30 gay men killed in really vicious ways here. Never was one of them a leather guy. These are always, you know, your average guy. And very often it was clear that sadomasochism was involved. And this again continues in the 1980s, and the community was getting fed up with it. And they knew it was, you know, one or more guys that was either coming and going from San Francisco and was hanging out in South of Market where all the leather bars were. At the same time, this is contrasted with they were called gay missionaries rather derogatorily by the gay community because these guys would use this as activism to represent the community. And, you know, you'd see letters to the editors where someone would say, you know, who the hell ever asked these people to speak for us? And so here's, you know, 30 guys, and there's, you know, a lot more that we could talk about. But right now, you know, it's amazing that people don't know about this. And as this case is being reborn, I'm going to make sure all the names and I'm trying to get all the pictures and get out there just how many are dead. I have to dissect really how many serials are involved here, if any, because you'd be surprised how common knifing was.
Yes,
knifing and strangling.
Yes.
And so that's where at the stage I'm still at. I'm communicating with a couple of other investigators very quietly, and we're sharing cases.
I wanted to tell you this because I haven't told you this before, but something I started wondering about today. I mean, I came out in the 80s, in the early 80s, in the AIDSies. And I lived in New York, and I worked in the gay community, and I had access to a lot of records and stuff from the 70s. And I was obsessed with true crime then. And I was looking today at a few cases. I mean, it is possible that this extends to other cities because we had, and at that time you had San Francisco, New York, and LA. And it was very common for gay men to travel between all the three cities on business and pleasure vacations. It was like this little, they were all these safe zones, you know, the Village in New York, San Francisco, the gay neighborhoods, and then West Hollywood in Los Angeles. So it's possible. I mean, there are so many unsolved leather murders in New York City. You know, I mean, who knows? Did this guy go on vacation there and have some fun? I mean, who can say? You know, it's really it's mind blowing when you think about it. And something else I wanted to add to something you were alluding to earlier. One of the big problems, and this is a big problem with the movie Cruising, which I think is an amazing film. The movie Cruising was incredibly controversial. And I remember I was old enough to understand it at the time. And this is also connects to what you're talking about, the way the murders reported, how they were talked about within the community. There was a huge rift between the, quote, normal gays and the leather people. They thought that the leather people were sick. They thought they were a negative portrayal. They thought that they would be used by the religious right to hurt them. They didn't want them going to gay pride parades. So the community was really divided. And I think that that was a lot of it too. They wanted at that time, you know, the Harvey Milk years, it was all about being gay is great. And they thought this was negative publicity. You know, and they wanted to play it down. And remember at the beginning of Cruising, they were forced to add that little thing. This is not what real gays are like. This is a tiny.
I have gay friends who used to love that movie who've turned on it. That because it's, I guess it's fallen out of fashion.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it in a while, but I couldn't wait to see it when I was young. I was like, oh, I want to see this.
it's one of my favorite Friedkin films. You know.
Well, that's what San Francisco was like.
Yeah, I mean,
the community was terribly divided. They knew South Park was a problem.
Yes,
and there was a place on Mason Street where guys could take their slaves. It was a daycare for sados, and they could take their slaves.
Jesus,
I'm serious. It was hilarious when I read it, and of course, the Bay Area Reporter is just, you know, denouncing this. You can see in his entire, you know, writing style. And it was up on Mason Street, which is Tenderloin. This is right by all the bars. And the guy could walk his slave in on the leash with the, you know, mask on, buttoned over, whatever. And it was a daycare, like a veterinary clinic, where they take care of the guy for the day. He comes back in 8 hours and walks the guy back home or to the bars.
That's fucking fantastic.
And in 1980, this CBS is balking against the public display that's going on. CBS 5 did that 1979 local documentary as gay culture going too far in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And they're quoting a gay guy in, several in Castro when the nightlife is moving to Castro, which was viewed as a neighborhood of straights and gays. This was a real neighborhood. The bars serviced a neighborhood. This is not the unabashed hedonism as everybody would cheer when that would be said in Tenderloin and south of Market. This was not that culture and they didn't want it coming in here. And they considered it, you know, just disgusting to see these guys groping each other or, you know, kissing a nipple on the street and all that. And he said, this has to stop. And it was still going, you know, and the leather guys were coming in more. And actually, the murders do move westward. When I talk about this second great wave in the 80s, it was going to Buena Vista Park now. It was going to the Castro bars. It was moving into Lower Haight, which is just north of Castro.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
What? You sound very trepidatious. Very authoritarian. It's like being with Mr. Sands back in grade 3, who just scared the shit out of me. Was there also a gay female population in that area as well, or was it more predominantly men?
It was really never mentioned much.
Yeah,
quite an active a lesbian community, but
it was very different. Yeah, it was very different.
Was it?
You know, those are the days when lesbians didn't really have sex with each other. They were lesbians for a political statement against men.
Separatists, like Janice Ian.
The separatist lesbians, Holly Near, you know, that whole period.
Yeah.
And there were some lesbians, but lesbians didn't come out. I mean, I'm sure that there always were, but lesbians didn't really come out into like S&M and things until the late 80s and 90s. Those communities started to become more visible. There were lesbian bars, but the gay boys were the ones having all the fun.
Is it true they don't like each other?
Oh, they hated each other.
Still do or did back then?
Who hated each other?
They really hated each other. If the AIDS crisis is what got them to drop a lot of their animosity towards each other.
Okay. Who hated each other?
The gays and lesbians
for a long time. In fact, it wasn't even the gay and lesbian community until the 80s. You know, it was gay movement and the lesbian movement. But
now it's a whole bunch of...
Now it's a whole bunch of stuff.
The alphabet.
You know, lesbians and leather guys were never the victims, ever. There was only one in 1980 who was more or less a cosplayer. He liked leather, but he didn't have a bike or anything, but he liked to go there. Paul Hayes was his name, and he ended up, you know, strangled and his body dumped Mount Tamalpais entrance, where a lot of guys and gals end up, unfortunately, in Mount Tamalpais, which is Marin County. That's north of the Bay Bridge, of the Golden Gate Bridge. But never was there a woman, never was there a leather guy who was a victim in all these waves of murder. It was only men. There was some connection to sadomasochism. There was some connection to a South of Market bar. Far more than the Castro. You'll see the narrative spin today that it was the Castro. The Castro was a neighborhood. They were resisting Tenderloin and South of Market trying to get in there, which eventually they did. They were, they're complaining. And there was a letter to the editor in the Sentinel in the early 1980s that the bars are kicking out walls here now in the Castro to accompany more. The leather guys are seen down the street. The groping is going on. The stationary stores are a little better than pornographic stores. And
It never got as bad. I mean, that's a subjective term, but it was never, you're right. It did increase, but it never got to the same point as like Folsom and.
Oh yeah. Folsom is South of Market. That's the center of, of leather. That's where the brig and the barracks were and the glory holes.
Yes.
6th and Folsom. It was on Folsom, right off Folsom, where David Rial was murdered. He was the one who just came out of the brig. He was strangled in the alley and mutilated. When I mentioned it, 75. Dennis Dickinson was also murdered there.
No, seriously, the song San Francisco, you got me. They mention all these streets, Folsom, Castro, Polk.
Uh-huh. Oh, no, I love that song. I was playing it before we started to get in the mood.
You need to hear the village people get in the mood. Okay. That's good.
I want to talk about all these murders. I love it.
No, you need something to lighten the mood, I guess, don't you?
Yeah.
At least one of them.
I thought I was mentioning too many names.
No, you're doing great. You're doing great.
And, you know, to contrast these killings, that's why the gay community knew these were gay killers, is that there were hate crimes at the time, of course, but they were so distinctively different. There'd be someone shouting, faggot in the street, gunshots going off, beatings, knifings in public.
Yeah.
Like that kind of stuff. But this, where someone is stalked and they're killed within their apartment. Yeah, that was something a very different matter. This was someone being solicited, or they were killed at trysting locations that were very popular.
And the mutilation is a sign too. You know, I mean, and frankly, aren't most serial killers, most of them have a sadomasochistic or bondage aspect? I mean, it's a sexual thing for the most part.
Yep. Very personal.
Like Zodiac.
So, yeah. So it's
these were always very silent murders.
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
not shootings. And, SFPD was very much certain that this was all done. This was all sadomasochism going loose. They weren't never going to say a serial killer because they weren't going to elevate this, I guess, at the time to something that should be connected. But, in one incident, there was a real nut going around getting in to apartments and then stripping the guys down and binding them up. Well, then he rummaged through the place, robbing it. And one guy, knew what was going to happen to him. And he hobbles out of bed, still bound. He starts shouting out the window for help. The guy comes back in the room, so he just throws himself out. and he goes down three floors, bound, hits the lawn in the yard. This is at Larkin. And the police finally get there, and the cop is joking that you should be more careful who you pick to do your bondage with, and he's insisting this guy broke in. He wanted their names. They refused to give it. They wouldn't call an ambulance for him because they assumed this guy was, you know, it was his fault for engaging in all this with some guy. And he had to wait till friends came home later and took him to the hospital, and it discovered he was bleeding internally and had a punctured bladder. Yeah. And that was kind of the attitude of SFPD, that this was just so commonplace.
Yeah.
That's full on.
So there's no real investigation of a serial afoot. And certainly I believe one was coming and going from San Francisco and to Seattle. That was quite commonplace. Mm-hmm. One was later killed by one of his victims. That would be Hendrix was his name. He killed a couple guys in 1979, strangled them in his van. And they tried to fix him with those who wanted to rehabilitate Lycan's name. They tried to fix him with having done the clone murders earlier in 78, and it just never worked. But the guy's name is Hendrix, and he finally tried to kidnap an army guy off duty, get him into his van to kill him. And the army guy wrestled Hendrix's gun away from himself and shot him and killed him. And then others, it's clear, you know, this was going back and forth between LA and San Francisco and New York, as Dan said. I think I mentioned in my latest blog post that in 1971, Jackie, who was the name of the guy who worked at the Trap, which was a really notorious gay bar on Eddy Street, was strangled in bed by someone. SFPD then informed the community, and they thanked him in this Friendly Fuzz article in the Bay Area Reporter. But Kansas City police got the killer, and they were able to connect him to this murder in San Francisco. And supposedly this guy had 13 other victims, gay victims in the country. And I don't even have the names for any of this.
That's
1971. Nice. That's 1971 already. And you go over 40 murders between, you know, 74 and 85, where it finally kind of ends with Clifford St. Joseph and the gay cult killers, the Satan worshipers that mutilated and sacrificed that guy. That he's still John Doe number 60. And what they did to him was very similar to what was going on in these bondage murders of the Sadom.
Tell him about Clifford.
Well, I wonder, you know, I've been tracking Clifford. He was a middle-aged man at the time. He was a waiter. He used to live on Geary. I found an earlier address in 78. So he was right in the Tenderloin when all this was going on. He moves out to 93 Stillman Road, which is, you can call it south of Market. It's more or less like South Park, the other side of the highway from south of Market. But I don't know, you know, he hooks up with Maurice Bork, who was a Canadian on the outs with Canada, and Ed Spela and so forth. And this 21 or 17-year-old, the age differs, Ricky Hunter. And so they're into some kind of bondage event. Ricky is a homeless prostitute. And so he stays there to be the Sado slave. They hook him up to the radiator and they let him go to get, you know, cigarettes and all that. And he comes back. And wherever they got this poor drunken, about 5'5" young guy, John Doe, and, you know, they kill him. They sacrifice him, draw a pentagram on his chest, mutilate him. Good. Which means slice the scrotum open.
Yikes.
All this kind of stuff that was done with done on Claude DeMott and Nick Baum and another one who was killed in 75 in a basement in which his reproductive area was pulverized. It was stomped so much. And so they do all this stuff. According to one of the participants, Clifford St. Joseph slices his lips to drink his blood. There's all this ritual stuff. It's kind of like Dummy's Guide to Devil's Worship. So they wrap him up in a yellow blanket, I guess. They dump him south of the China Basin inlet there, which has been completely redone. And his body is discovered. And they are, a couple years later, eventually able to trace it to 93 Stillman and Clifford and Maurice Bork and Danny Hunter. Bork actually starts turning evidence, and Danny Hunter starts too. And there are those who tried to rehabilitate Clifford St. Joseph in a 2003 SF Gate article, which is pretty weak.
Excuse me.
But Clifford does 34 years for that. Maurice Bork was already suffering life in prison for something else. He also carved up some other guy and put a pentagram on him. So that gets a big write-up. The Sentinel writes that there may be, the murder may be related to a gay cult ritual. And then the BAR, when they're sentenced in 1988, does a big thing, you know, the gay cult killers. And I just don't know. I don't see how, you know, they're trying to blame.
Different.
What?
They seem like different.
Yeah, the way they dumped him, it was very unprofessional. I mean, they couldn't help but find the body there by the wrecking
yard. You forgot about the part they dripped hot wax into his eyes.
Yes, his right eye, supposedly. And Ed Spela was talking with good old Geraldo Rivera in that 1988 documentary. They were right there at the apartment.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot different to it, and there's a lot similar early on. I just, those who try and rehabilitate Clifford St. Joseph and say it was Maurice Bork who really did this and Clifford was just too stupid to let him in and share apartment with him. I don't know how, you know, he's going to engage in all this suddenly after a few weeks of knowing this guy. So who is involved in these, you know, we're talking about many suspects, potential suspects who just were not investigated in a slew of these killings. And when you begin to understand them, you see how the doodler concept kind of shrinks. You know, I don't know really who to associate him with, except three guys who survived. Might have been involved in soliciting cocaine more than sex. And he's now a 70-year-old guy living in Oakland still, I'm told.
Bruce Lee.
And just how much can we blame the doodler? And in resurrecting this crime spree, I'm simply not going to, you know, go with the narrative and try and say it's really all these are doodler crimes. This was someone very adroit in sadomasochism in South of Market, and that doesn't fit the doodler at all.
I think so, too.
I have a question. One of the people who supposedly encountered him was a famous actor. Do we know who that was? Are there any guesses as to who that was?
Quote, a nationally known entertainer.
Yeah.
Unquote. I have insights, but of course I'm not going to say any names, but.
Why not? Say it or get out of here.
Because he's still alive.
Not Rock Hudson?
No. Everybody says Rock Hudson or Richard Chamberlain. I don't know why. It's because there's names that they easily pull out of the hat.
Cary Grant.
Yeah.
Cary Grant. Some documentary on YouTube said Cary Grant.
I heard Cary Grant thrown around as well.
Andy D.
He was close to 80 years old.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I think you have to go back in time to think of who would be around at that time.
Rip Torn. No, Rip Taylor.
Rip Taylor.
No, Rip Taylor.
Taylor.
Yeah, Rip Taylor.
Yeah.
Rip Torn.
Rip Torn put a fucking hammer to my head. Have you heard that?
Now listen here. I want to go back to my apartment for some sex.
Rip Taylor. That's what I meant.
Rip Taylor.
He'd be so loud.
He's throwing confetti.
He's throwing sparkles at confetti.
Threw confetti at the doodler as he tried to stab him. Yeah. Singing opera while he's doing it.
But that's something like.
Well, I don't even know if the nationally known entertainer was attacked, according to what is said now.
That
the guy took his jacket or something off and the knife fell out.
Yeah.
That's when the guy said out, or there was a struggle then?
I think he just bolted, is what I heard.
Yeah.
But, you know,
the address.
But that seems like the thing with the survivors is, you know, some reporters have talked to some of these people, but you don't, you know, they don't want you to know who they are. So, you know, that there's sort of that's one of the things about this case is that because of the nature of it, a lot of people don't want their names out
and
there.
And also when it happened. You know,
you're
talking in the 70s, so there were no celebrities out of the closet yet.
Yeah, it was shocking when Rock Hudson died of AIDS, you know.
Right,
Well, and then the speaker, whether this was more cocaine related, the prominent citizen wasn't gay. You see, he maintained that apartment. He lived elsewhere with his family, but he maintained that apartment when in town. And I wouldn't believe the police report if I've seen it from what I've heard. That somehow the doodler just came back to the same floor two doors down from where he attacked the diplomat and said, can I use your phone? And the guy let him in. And then he got bound up and he's kicking the wall to get help. And, you know, it just doesn't make sense. It sounds like an excuse to explain when they get here why this guy was here.
Yeah.
You know, and he's not going to say, well, I encountered him on Market Street, invited him up here. But what for? You know.
Right. Cocaine or gay sex or whatever.
Yeah. Neither was going to go over. Either would ruin him.
Right.
A nice night of coke and cock.
I've been there.
Oh. Are you gay? I didn't realize. Shit.
So, I hope I'm not doing like too much of a. What do they call it? It's not Uncle. What do they call it when it's Uncle Charlie's used to call him?
What?
You don't know. Uncle Charlie's was this white boy gay bar where everyone wanted to be straight. It was like the Uncle Tom gay people. I hope I'm not trying to make the straight people laugh. I want to get back to the business at hand, which is murder. Were these people robbed? Were the doodle victims robbed? I know I heard it somewhere, but I forgot.
Some of these guys were robbed.
Yeah.
In different ways, including like a tape recorder taken from Robert Culver in the Castro, in which the killer did leave doodles behind, but was not a black guy. He was described more as a cross between, they thought he was Latino or Asian with longer shoulder length hair. But he had stayed hours in his apartment with the dead body there, shot with a pillowcase on the head. And he left doodles of cars and balloons. And interestingly, that's similar to a 1980 murder I've recently uncovered on Roosevelt Way by Buena Vista Park, in which a psychiatric nurse named Jim Palmer came home after work at the hospital in Oakland and was shot 5 times by a guy in the apartment. And his roommate comes back an hour later and he sees his roommate dead and rolled up in a carpet in the hallway, and the guy's still there. The killer is still there, and the killer chases him out. He's running down Roosevelt Way calling for help, and finally the police come out. And it's very similar to what happened with Robert Culver, where the guy just stayed there for hours, it was thought. And when people saw him in the window and approached, he jumped out. They heard him go over the fence and back. And this is similar to the guy that threw himself out of the window. This guy came in there and was doing that, you know, he didn't know if he was going to be killed in whatever kind of way. So he threw himself out the window. But it's similar that, you know, these were not always, even when you get the gun, murder by gun, they're strange. There's someone up to something strange in the house that it's not just killing. They hang around.
Jeez.
And, you know, gay guys were considered easy victims too at the time.
Right.
Yeah, they were for a long time.
Was it because people thought that their deaths weren't, it was like killing a hooker or something, like society wouldn't care? Or was
that might have been part of it, but I mean, they're also easy marks. I mean, they're drunk, you know, I mean, you're talking about late at night, they're drunk, they're horny. Mm-hmm. You can lure one home. You can lure one into an alley. They will go to an alley with a stranger, you know, I mean, it goes on.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense too.
Also, at the time when the Polk Street Hustlers really started getting to be a problem, you know, gay guys could be hooked up with, especially at the Trap. And then these young guys would go home with the older guys and they could rob them blind. And the older guys aren't going to say anything to the police. They don't want to be outed. And so they were easy to rob. And later, after Harvey Milk is on the board and then Harry Britt later, you know, SFPD had to investigate more. And that's when the Polk Street Hustlers began a problem. They started killing the guys in very vicious ways. Then if they would be caught, they would claim it was homosexual panic that these old pervs made in advance. Mm-hmm. And you'd be surprised, in one very celeb case in town locally, Gangway Susie, high-end drag performer on Polk, real name Alfred Schlazewski, 52 years old. He goes, there's this big celebration for his anniversary of doing something in the shows. He goes out, hooks up with a guy at one of the restaurants, at one of the bars, and this young guy just makes his apartment a bloodbath with a knife. His name was Doug Tony, 26, 27, like that. And he goes to trial and he gets off on self-defense. Wow. And when that's done shortly thereafter to a cab driver who is well-known and liked in the community, James West, the papers are reporting they fear the same thing's going to happen, that it's, you know, self-defense against a perv, and he's going to get off on that. And that was done quite a few times.
It's a lesson. It's a lesson that gay men have to learn when they're young about getting into danger, you know, especially in those days. I have a little story that I was saving that I've been sitting on here. When I was a young man in New York, I was obsessed with celebrities and being cool. And I used to hang out in a nightclub called The Limelight, which is famous, infamous. This is before Michael Alec and everything. But a friend of a friend worked the VIP room there. And I would go up and hang out in the VIP room and hang out with celebrities. And I was young and cute, and they thought I was fun. And I used to go up there. And one night, I don't go up there. Something else happened. I don't go up there. And it's the night that an art student named Igel Dagbesti disappears from the Limelight VIP room. This is the Crispo case. This is an S&M murder. He was found in a shed in Long Island. His body had been burned to death. He'd been burned, tortured, and eaten by animals. And the only reason they could identify him is that he had a leather mask on that preserved his face.
Wow.
And the guy, and Andrew Crispo was a multimillionaire, still is, art dealer. And everyone thought he did it. He was notoriously sadistic. And his henchman, his sidekick, took the rap and went to prison. They got Crispo years later for tax evasion. I talked to my friend. He said, I wasn't here that night, thank God. I said they must be going crazy there. I knew then that I was playing with fire. And that I couldn't just go out all hours of the night, talk to whoever came around, go whoever, you know, I thought I was Holly Golightly. I thought I was having fun and going to, and I, that was a wake up call. And I'm so grateful that it happened when I was in my early 20s. But I'm telling you, this affects everyday people.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I wanted to share that with you, but make it personal. Personal story out of it.
No, that's yeah, that's incredibly interesting. Yeah,
jeez,
that's very common. What San Francisco? Those that were solved. Some mm-hmm. murders were solved, and then as another case, the one who has been identified recently, in the last few years at Ocean Beach, he was a John Doe, young teenage guy who was shot 3 times and basically nude and then buried at Ocean Beach. Near, Travala, I forget the street name, Tarava. And he was a young guy. Maybe he was hustling. I don't know. He was a runaway. But the number of guys that also vanish, there's only inferences mm-hmm. now about them. I can't find a list. I haven't looked really hard yet since I'm so involved in simply trying to identify more murders that should have been given more attention already. And still trying to identify, is there a serial involved here? Where is he? I think there was one high-end guy. I think that we do have a genuine type of, you know, top hat ripper here who's coming and going. And he clearly is working, you know, south of Market. He knows the leather business, shall we say. And so was he local or was he, you know, coming and going from New York, L.A., Seattle? But the doodler kind of pales by comparison. This impulsive knifer whose victims survive. And clearly this is not an expert in gay solicitation or sadomasochism at all. The doodler is not, I'm saying.
No, I agree.
And, you know, I found out where the 14 number comes from, why it's always recited with the 5. Poor Dianne Feinstein, again, she was to be at a meeting at the SIR, what did SIR stand for? S-I-R? In any case, it was to be a big meeting, but they got wind that the murders were going to be talked about, and she was leaked that they were going to mention 14, the number 14. And so that's where it came from. It was reported in the gay newspapers. It got reported in, I think, mainstream stuff. And so I think that's just where Port 14 keeps being pulled out from, that there were these 14 murders. So when Toski basically engineered letting the other five get out, the papers just connected to the 14 that had come up in this big controversy when Dianne Feinstein, they tried to ambush Dianne Feinstein with stats on what was going on.
Dianne Feinstein was going to tell them all about Richard Ramirez and the Shoei War. And, you know, she was going to.
She always got in trouble.
She was going to divulge all these key details that only the killer and the cops knew.
Have you seen Gay Politics, Gay Power?
No.
CBS is big. It's on YouTube. Unfortunately, the guy put his own, you know, watermark right in the center of it. It was incredibly controversial in 1980. CBS was being condemned by the gay community for how it was portrayed. They were made to retract something. They were turned into the Journalistic Ethical Bureau or whatever. In any case, it was hosted. Well, Harry Reasoner introduced it and then gave the final say. And it was an hour-long documentary that was supposed to show how gay power was increasing in politics, how these guys were moving up and getting influential. And what it did was it concentrated on the most sordid aspects of sadomasochism, of the, you know, the guy that specializes in teaching bondage. The coroner was on there, Stephen Boyce, Boyce Stevens, saying how they've got, you know, guys counseling them on how to identify a sado murder.
Isn't there a guy in there that says it leaves some interesting marks?
He was their expert. They caught him on Castro Street.
Yes.
Wow.
He claimed to be, he was the consultant. And it showed, you know, they went to Buena Vista Park as everything moved west. Buena Vista became the trysting location. And they sat there with their cameras watching guys come and go from the bushes, all this sex during the day, and then talked to little kids, how shocked they were. And of course, the whole community was upset by this. Unfortunately, you know, for the sordid aspect of it, it's a true enough documentary, despite how condemned it was back then, 40 years ago. But it didn't show what it said they were going to show. They didn't show the normal, quote unquote, gays who were getting in politics, like, you know, like Harvey Milk did and Harry Britt. It showed the sordid nightlife, which is, of course, something I'm more interested in, because it is that sordid nightlife in which the killer was stalking and in which the victims were being killed. But it's pretty shocking what they were showing, how what Sado was really like. And I can see why people would be offended by all that.
And now just imagine if you were to leave out an initial in LGBTQNY plus whatever it is, CBS would like get you fired from your job.
Yeah.
Back then, CBS locally was very much going against.
They're like, they're demons, they're evil. And now they're like, how dare you leave out an initial?
And see, nowadays, even Dan can't remember the letters, like all of them. I don't see how they keep up. It's
everybody crazy. But the people on this show, pretty much.
Yeah,
I mean, it's including everybody. They're so inclusive that everybody's in the group now.
So actually, I wanted to ask the Q Man about Dave Toschi, because it seems like our listeners are probably familiar with him because he's played by Mark Ruffalo in the Zodiac film. And there's now a kind of fake stories going around that he actually inspired Bullitt and Dirty Harry.
That's rubbish.
Yeah, he's sort of this publicity.
Well the Zodiac furthers that narrative.
Right, it does.
The Zodiac case made him a celebrity locally. Mm-hmm. Before, it was just, you know, rumored within the SFPD, you know, to the extent that he influenced Steve McQueen in the movie Bullitt in 1968. He was a vice cop back then and gave him tips on how to play the part. But Steve McQueen really liked his quick draw holster and his casual way of dressing. And that's basically what Steve McQueen imitated. But Bullitt was entirely his character.
Right.
Then he switched to Homicide about a year. So he's still a rookie on Homicide. He gets the Zodiac case with Bill Armstrong, his partner. And he did have a kink for publicity. Earl Sanders admitted that in his book in 2006 on the zebra killings. They said everybody knew it. He, you know, kind of like he had a Rolodex. He'd call these guys, and the reporters were getting to the crime scene before the cops. And he just really loved his name in print, not on TV. He had a kink about it in print. And so he really catered to the papers, the magazines, and the local newspapers. And I kind of, you know, giggle it off in Horoscope as I write on Zodiac. I do a chapter about the aftermath. I call it Titwillow because it's, you know, the aftermath of the after the Zodiac disappears. And it covers how Toski was, you know, basically humiliated and disappears from the newspapers thereafter, even after he's quietly restored to homicide. He was demoted to pawn shop when they discovered that he was writing fan mail to himself. He was featured for real in Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City, which was the biggest publicity he ever had. He plays himself, a real-life cop, counseling a junior kind of amateur cop, Henry Tandy, in search of this killer called Tinkerbell. Get it? Uh-huh. And so I, you know, well, he wrote letters. When he was written out of the serial, he wrote letters under the guise of these are female admirers. So he wrote three or four calling himself an adorable curly-haired guy, a good officer, a real police officer, and all this kind of stuff. And Armistead Maupin recognized the printing from the Christmas card he had sent him. He kept it for a couple years when that fake Zodiac letter was sent in 1978. Toski sends it for some strange reason to Shimoda, John Shimoda, across the bay in San Bruno, the postal inspector, who says, oh, this is real. Gets his big news, you know, release. This goes national, international, that Zodiac killer has written again. And he's mentioned in there, you know, that city pig Toski is good, but I'm better and smarter. And Herb Cain is mentioned in there, who was San Francisco's number one columnist. Any mention of Herb Cain is going to get news. And then it's coming out that, you know, Maupin, through his through Ken Maley, his publicist, who is a well-known gay man, suspects that maybe Toski's writing these fake Zodiac letters as well. And Maley goes to Jim Tedesco, Toski's superior, and it all goes south from there. The Zodiac letter is fake. When questioned, documents actually looks at it. It's clear it's a tracing. Toski is demoted. He has to admit that he wrote this fan mail to himself. It's splattered all over this corkboard, you know, fan mail from a cop. SFPD demotes him. There's the ego conflicts. Glenn D'Amica said in an interview he was assistant chief of police. So Toski really burned. He just spiraled out.
See, that's really
and unfair. He is then elevated to homicide later, but his name is gone from the news compared to what it was. Now, I kind of giggle that off in Horoscope, because, well, he was vain. He was a really charming guy, but he loved the press. But when I started digging into Doodler stuff, I finally came across that these were Toski's cases. He really catered to the gay press. He promoted himself as their friend during this very violent period. And he was the one going to the bars showing the Doodler sketch. And they wrote him up doing this, that he was the one doing it. They thought he was very industrious for this. He was their friend when the BAR did this scathing piece on him as well during his collapse when he fell from grace over the Zodiac letter. You know, then the BAR got in the fight with the Senate, with the Sentinel, that condemned them for maligning one of the greatest friends the gay community has had. But it seems, you know, when you look at the coroner reports and you see that one of these guys, the Harold Goldberg, he probably wasn't even murdered. He was a 66-year-old guy. He had sacrificed half of his teeth on the altar of malt and hops. The other half that were remaining were rotted away. His zipper was down, yes, but his bladder was empty. Did he stumble and sail down the embankment and scratch himself up? Because that's basically what he had, scratches on his neck and his wrist. And you know, why are these being put out there? Why was Jay Stevens put out there when Jay Stevens was really high-end performer, drag performer? He stunned people by imitating Harlow. They didn't even know it was a man. He got a cameo in The Laughing Policeman with Walter Matthau. He was in legitimate cabaret. And again, the implication is there could be a drug connection. His car was involved in an incident that day. There's rumors, there's accusations that a member of his family did it. then just why are these disconnected cases being put out there with the doodler name on them and then 14 others name unknown? And I could basically only trace it to Dave Toski, that he was during the time of, you know, Maupin's great serial hunting Tinkerbell, and he was maybe trying to create, this is speculation on my part, it's not very nice, but he was trying to create a real life version of Tales of the City in which he's hunting a guy killing gay guys.
So it's almost like a 70s gay version of the smiley face murders or whatever.
Yes, you had mentioned that to me before. I thought that was a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
I was going to say, perfect comparison. Very, very unfair what they did to him, you know, because, I mean, we spend all our time giving ourselves one-star reviews on places. So, you know.
Yeah. I like to pretend I'm more hated than I am.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, you'll know the ones I wrote, because the ones that are most scathing of myself are the ones I wrote with the one-star reviews. I get so entrenched in hating on myself, fire another person, another personality, that I get carried away sometimes.
Yeah. It's understandable.
I know.
Yeah.
But I've got a new one written up where I attack you, Hunter. So, yeah.
Good, good. We need to, you know, make sure.
Yeah.
People have to write favorable reviews of me.
Yeah. They'll say we only listen when Quasar's here. The only time we listen. So we have
I'm trying to get a nice review. I was on someone who's won the Edward R. Murrow Award for journalism. He said such a wonderful thing from his radio interview. And I said, oh, can you write that down for me? And yeah, he's promised. And so far I have not gotten it.
Oh, darn.
He calls me the true American.
Like Hulk Hogan.
Well, I'll have to finish reading your Scarlet Autumn book and post a review.
You can read it for free for the remaining month if you have Kindle Unlimited.
Yeah, you hear that, listeners? You got Kindle Unlimited. You can read the Q-Man's
book. It really
does
not pay to advertise it, but...
Yes, I would imagine so. So, do you think that what Toshi did in the 70s, that this has kind of plagued the case since? Because now with the fake internet journalism, quote-unquote... how it's kind of distorted things and the details and how
it's just, yeah, it cycles that narrative.
Yeah.
We're still very early in this becoming something big, and it can be likened to, you know, Whitechapel in the 1880s. There was a lot of course, immigration to Whitechapel. It was pretty seedy.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, the Ripper was going around preying on those that were easily available. And that's exactly what San Francisco was like at this time. It was a revolving door. They were coming. Gays were coming from the entire country because of the quote unquote liberal atmosphere of San Francisco. And they didn't know the town. They didn't really know the danger spots. And clearly, obviously, this was, you know, the victims were very obvious that they were being hunted by someone quite clever. So you do have someone who could be a John, as they called him, a high end guy who was, getting his kicks by killing the weaker ones, but of course never, once again, a leather guy. Never was a leather guy victim. And it is very similar. You know, if you study the Ripper and that era of London, you'll see so many similarities to San Francisco, as it was a culture in convulsion at the time, not just with gay culture coming in, but with, you know, it was the wake of the counterculture. We were in the anti-establishment. You got the zebra killers out there. You had the Symbionese Liberation Army coming and going through cities. It was quite a violent time of upheaval, and Zodiac making communication here and there. And all this plays off in the background, and you don't really hear about it because these are Tenderloin and South of Market murders. This is the dregs of, you know, society, whether straight or gay. This is not the greatest part of town. You know, the bar crowd murders were never worthy of much news.
Right.
There's only one gay elected official, Harvey Milk. You know, there's no...
Eventually, yeah.
There's no structure. The cops are still not trusted for the most part, and it takes a while. So you've got the wild factors coming in, but there's no structure around it yet. There's no safety.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the times of the murders, like from 75 on.
Yeah. Yeah. Harvey Milk was elected, what, in 77, 78, finally gets elected?
Something like that.
And, 1976, Channel 7 did a very interesting documentary. They've got it back on Look, The Bay Gays. Is that what it's called? It's on YouTube. I believe you can find it now as they introduce it and go back in time. But it's pretty, you know, honest how it's reported how one spokesman is saying that this idea that gays are accepted in San Francisco is false. There's a difference between acceptance and tolerance. Gays are tolerated in San Francisco. They're not accepted. And so you have all these factors playing in to why the community was isolating itself, why they didn't trust the police, and why it was pretty easy to go knock off a guy at night in those neighborhoods.
It was a time of change because I was thinking, I mean, what about the Beatniks? What about the Cockettes? What about John Waters and Divine? You know, they're there in the late 60s, early 70s. So there were people that were extremely liberated, you know, that were far beyond anything we've got now, you know. But at the same time, the average person, you know, I mean, when Harvey Milk was in office, most gay people weren't out of the closet yet. That was one of his big issues, was try to get people out of the closet. You know, it was a different time. And even in San Francisco, I read that a huge percentage, their parents didn't know they were gay. So these are all factors in why things happen.
And if you look back at old coroner registers and so forth, and newspapers, you don't see all these murders, even in the tumultuous time of the late 60s, when a lot of nutty stuff was going on with LSD and everything. As the gay community really began to take form in the 70s, in the wake of counterculture, in the wake of the Beatniks, you know, again, you got the leather crowd, you got all this stuff moving in, and then
the
it's near the 70s.
Crowd.
Yeah, the Crisco disco. And in the early 70s, you begin to hear just snippets of murders, and that's really what I have to go on for some of these. One guy goes into a rant in the gay newspaper in 1972, castigating them about their attitude about something. I don't know what it was. It was a letter to the editor. He signed it, but he says, what about the Ocean Beach murder? The J-Car murder, which I guess is that a J-Car on a BART train? I'm not sure. And then the Polk Street leather murder. And so these are obviously prior to all this, you know, the 1974.
Oh, yeah.
And it sounds
yeah.
like the exact same thing. We got another murder at Ocean Beach I have to look into. A J-Car murder, I have to even understand what that is. And a Polk Street leather murder, well, you can guess what is involved with that.
Uh-huh.
But then there's that lull again. There are some murders in San Jose in which a guy ends up strangled and tied up in his trunk. Another guy's attacked an apartment by a strange guy. But then it does slowly begin in 74, and the glut just happens in 75. And it just keeps on, you know, it dies out in January 76 when the vigilantes make their threat. And it moves west, very distinctly moves west to Castro, Northwell, Hayes Valley. It's something centered around Castro now, with one murder in Castro of Robert Culver. And it continues to move west. There's a couple that happen later, but then with, you know, the clone murders, if Likens did that or not, the victims were not even going to be dumped in town anymore. Either the cops are finally going to get them, or these guys were now scared of the gay vigilantes. And it moves west into the 1980s very distinctly with very similar murders. And, you know, it's a pattern that you have to consider when you're dealing with 40 murders, that something truly unique within this vast crime spree, this decade, started in 75 and may be connected to some of the stuff in 74 and may be connected to a few of those in 76.
Mm-hmm.
But there was someone who really just went wild, and it was vicious. It was sadistic, and it wasn't strung together. And to this day, I'm the only one trying to string it together publicly. There's two other people who are investigating who've communicated with me. And right now we're very quiet that we're communicating. Probably should not have even said that. But it's a question, once again, of trying to gather all the names. And it's just, you know, you want to try and analyze this and say, yes, these are all connected to this serial killer, whether it be Jack the Knife, the name I tentatively give him, or whatever name you want to apply, the Doodler or whomever. But still, more and more victims are found, and it's the killings are so similar that, you know, it's always strangling, it's always knifing, or, you know, bludgeoning here and there, the quiet ways, or something that happens sadistically. Very seldom gunshots, very seldom in public. And this is, you know, 40 murders over 10 years time, ending with Clifford and Bork and their satanic murder of apparently only one guy.
Now, is this satanic murder, you know, the one thing I always see memed around is the FBI never proved any satanic murders were real.
Oh, well, there's FBI guys that'll, the, you know, good old Geraldo in that 1988 thing. You can get it on YouTube.
Yeah.
The Devil's This or That, whatever it's called. I just watch it to see the clip on Clifford.
Right.
And it's got the FBI guy on there that says, yes, there are. And the local police don't want to believe.
Yes.
And they don't want to look into it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we have to qualify, what's a satanic murder? Are we talking high-end occult, like back in the days of Dr. John Dee or Nostradamus, burning right. Enochian tablets and all that? Are we talking about these, you know, counterculture, the anti-establishment mindset of the early 70s, where it was to sample the ultimate devil's advocate, the intellectual questioning, this dummy's guide to devil's worship people who, you know, are worshiping ISIS and writing, you know, Hail ISIS on these rocks out in the in these circle that they go to their little rituals, like something. There was that that movie, Devil Rides Out or something, you know, Peter Fonda.
Yeah. Oh, that was great.
With Christopher Lee.
No, he's talking about Ride with the Devil with Peter Fonda.
No. Oh, yeah.
Peter Fonda.
That's the devil. That's Ride with the Devil.
It's Peter Fonda and Warren Oates.
The other one is a Hammer.
Stars, Christopher Lee.
Yeah. The Devil Rides Out is a
that's a Dennis Wheatley story.
Yeah, that's a Hammer.
So good.
That's a Hammer movie.
Yeah. Good film.
But you know, that's, you know, so how do we qualify? Because,
and
you know,
but another strain of that is the kid who stabs people and goes, I did it for Satan. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that real devil worship, or?
I pretty much believe the worst of everybody at all times. it's satanic until proven panic.
That is great. I'm putting that in my back pocket, Dan. It's satanic until
proven. That's going to have to be the title of a future show.
It's the title of this show.
That's why.
Don't get me started.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to bring that up earlier with these killings when I see the extent of the mutilations and the similar slicings that, you know.
Right.
Yeah, certainly if Clifford didn't do anything earlier, they knew what this represented. Bork certainly did.
I don't really see a satanic connection to this case except for Clifford, but we don't know if Clifford's connected to the doodler, really. I mean, it's a potential, but there's nothing beyond the one. Oh, he just happened to write a pentagram on the victim's chest while they ceremoniously tortured him. Sure, it had nothing occult whatsoever. It's just a coincidence. Just a pentagram accidentally slipped and drew. Whatever.
He's just accidentally reading from Anton LaVey's Satanic.
Whatever.
While slashing him.
I was only listening to Slayer while I killed him. Come on.
You know what I think? You know what I think about the doodler, especially since he left Doodles, which I didn't know. To me, the doodler sounds like a season 2 Batman villain.
Hello, I'm Vincent Price, and I'm the doodler this week.
After they've used all the good villains, like they're starting to do, like the archer and the puzzler and the doodler.
Yeah.
He left a doodle behind, Robin.
Yes, Batman, I will draw your picture and then you will be trapped in this art frame.
One reason why I actually had to contemplate it for the earlier murders is that supposedly biker guys were really big into the devil worship stuff in the in the 1970s, and of course that is the South of Market crowd. They were big leather and biker guys, and as I say once again, they were never the victim.
Right,
never was one of them.
No, it's true. And look at the leather guys too. There's a lot of Satanism in the leather community too. I mean, who knows how much of it's real and how much of it's affectation, but.
I mean, yeah, you know, how much of it's posing, you know, like,
cosplay.
But that's kind of the whole thing, is how much of it's posing.
The effect is still the same.
Yeah, we used to call there was real leather, and then there was the S&M bars that we said stood for stand and model. So there's always been that element to it, you know, how convincing you were as a masculine tough.
So would Judas Priest be a stand-in model band?
Well, I guess they turned out to be, didn't they?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Be that Turbo Negro nice. Would definitely be.
I wanted to ask, this isn't a major point, but I wanted to ask Mr. QAnon.
I'm writing your quote down right now, just a minute. It's satanic until proven panic.
Proven panic, yeah. There's a book out called Last Call by Elon Green that came out this spring. That's about a similar string of murders in New York City in the 90s. Piano bars. I thought that was interesting. Thought I'd bring it to your attention.
The diplomat loved to go to the piano bar called the New Bell in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the higher end. That's when you go to the classier places. They're almost bohemian bars. There was an interesting series of articles back when, I think, in the Sentinel in the early 80s, in which some professor of this, that, or the other thing was documenting how the gay community began in San Francisco. And he said it was based on the Blue Discharge in World War II. Have you heard of those?
No.
He said there really was no such thing as a gay bar before the end of World War II. There were bohemian bars that were more inviting.
It doesn't surprise me. Oh, it doesn't surprise me.
And it said there was such things in San Francisco, the Black Cat and the Mona, and the high-end stuff would go to the Top of the Mark, where the officers
The Black Cat was in West Hollywood.
Well, there was one in San Francisco, too, apparently.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that's where the first modern-day gay riots were. They were 2 years before Stonewall in Los Angeles. The California people love bringing that up.
Territorial about their...
Because I lived in New York, and they were like, we had the first one here.
Well, let me check on the names.
You may well be right. I'm not that familiar with San Francisco. I've only visited once.
Well, according to this professor, his origins of all this, it was that gays were quite tolerated in World War II because every man was needed and they knew this stuff was going on. But in 1946, 47, when no longer needed, there was these massive discharges called Blue Discharge. And a lot of these guys didn't want to go home to mom with such a discharge. So they remained in San Francisco, where they all knew as you go to leave, you go to San Francisco. He said this is where it really begins, and where gay bars come from are the bohemian bars that were more, you know, the artsy crowd that were more tolerant and inclusive. I don't have a screen cap of that. I downloaded the entire. Any case, it was very interesting. It was Black Cat. I can get it to you on.
It could be a factor. That's interesting. I know that the war had a big effect because gay people met for the first time. And American gay men met other gay men. You know, everybody was isolated on the farm. And
yeah, that's what he was saying too. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of a building block.
And so all the guys released, you know, discharged in the Pacific, came to San Francisco and stayed.
Yeah.
And then those released in Europe came to New York and stayed. And that's why the two became the center.
That's interesting. Very
possible.
So,
see how educational this show is?
Yeah. We learned so much.
Has Stuart thrown up yet?
Several times.
He's
actually
muted himself
because he's just retching, you know. So what are some final thoughts on the Doodler, Q Man? What do you think? What are some of your main takeaways from this that you've seen that you want to get out there?
Well, I have a lot more coroner reports pending from the medical examiner's office. When I can read them all, I can try and figure out how many of these really are tied together to that MO. I just really don't know what to make of him. I believe in him in theory, but as a fact, I do not really believe in the Doodler. I know he's a guy involved in perhaps cocaine dealing that knifed a few or a couple guys, and there were survivors. You know, he's kind of so distinctive. I can't imagine someone in a watch cap in the 1970s doodling is not going to be easily identified by the community and, you know, apprehended on their own if the police won't do anything.
Dan, what about you?
I kind of agree. I think there's something there. I think it's more along the S&M angle. I mean, just looking at other serial killings, like I say, there's a sexual component. And the Doodler just seems like an after-school special. Like, he's this gay kid who's confused and doesn't know what to do. And he's a sensitive artist, you know, and he's got a mean therapist who's a Christian that's trying to make him turn ex-gay. It just doesn't add up to me.
It does seem like a kind of a modern sort of liberal narrative you'd see on a Netflix special or something.
TV movie.
Yeah.
And to me the real stuff to me is the sadomasochistic stuff. Just because, I mean, there's it's epidemic. It's been all over. It was all over New York in the 70s and 80s into the 90s. So I'm familiar with it. It's real. I know that it's out there. So to me, that's what makes most sense. That's what feels right to me.
Cool.
In this case, this was a guy that really decided to take it to a stalking level. I just don't know if he was permanently local, if he was coming and going. I've got to, you know, spread out to L.A. murders, Seattle, New York. The documentary that was one of these I've been watching to get back into the time period. I'm watching the local news stuff that's, you know, 45 years old. It's put on YouTube. And this high-end haberdasher on Polk Street was saying that gay men have more money to spend on all this stuff because they don't have kids. They don't have a family. And so they do spend a lot more, and they're more fashion conscious, or, you know, he's pushing his product.
Mm-hmm.
But they did have money to come and go from New York, Los Angeles. They were in higher end business and saving more of their money.
And so they didn't have families holding them down.
Yeah, that's what he said.
So,
where could this Jack the Knife be? Oh, you're back.
Well, I told you all I had a tradesman to deal with, and you just kept all talking like Americans do. Hey, so
exactly. That's what we do.
Well, I didn't understand you.
I'm usually very respectful to guests, so I will bite my tongue.
John Grace, what about you? Do you have any parting thoughts on the doodler?
I would say, I've been following this story for a couple of years and talking with Dan and John about it, and or Q Man. And I know that these guys have been doing so much research into this. I don't think any reporter or podcaster anywhere else is going to come close to the amount of knowledge these guys have collected.
And when you look at the mainstream reporting on this, it like Dan said, it very much reeks of an agenda. Like, how can we make this fit narratives that we want to push?
Yeah,
that's what's going on with this. That's the big takeaway I felt, because everything I looked into, I was going, okay, they're trying to make this to push a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just going to bury the crime spree even more. And mm-hmm. we're just at the brink of digging it up and presenting it. You know, what I've done so far is nothing compared to what I've uncovered and have to present on Q Files, with all the videos, with all the pictures of the historical references. You know, I have to put back the entire era to be faithful to the context of all this. if they're just going to use it for politics today, be anachronistic and try and apply it, it's just going to bury the names of the victims that people don't know anyway, unless, you know, they're reading my blog.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the only one mentioning all these other new names.
Plug your blog again.
It's just my blog. It's okay, not so even the website blog. Yet. So the blog is like a synopsis. It's for light extemporanea, but it's just, I don't know. It's Quester site blog on WordPress.
Okay.
And of course, then that you can link to it. I link in my updates on Q Files on the Questerfiles.com. So you can go to these. It's a rather artless blog compared to what everything will look like. But just like what I did with EARONS, that's what it's going to look like on Quester Files.
So if we want to solve this, if you're a comedian, get your wife to write a book about it and then kill her.
Yes.
Feed her a bunch of opiates.
Just the right prescription drug cocktail.
Yeah.
Do it every time. Combined with Starbucks. That'll do it.
Stuart, any final thoughts?
Yeah, this bloody cooling system's going to cost me a fortune. That's what my final thought is. A lot more than we thought. But about this, not really.
Well,
what do you want to say? This,
I don't know. I'm just
it happened saying, like no, just... 300 years ago. What do I care?
So, Quasar, thank you so much for coming on. It's always cool to do these kind of true crime deep dives with you into get your knowledge out there and share it with our listeners. And Dan, so excited to have you on.
Oh, thank you.
Love having you on.
I hope I didn't disappoint you.
No, not at all. Oh my gosh. Great stuff.
Wow. This is one they'll talk about for a long time, I think.
Yeah.
quote satanic into proven panic is great.
That's the title of the episode right there.
Oh man. Oh, it's so good.
It's like that ghost 7-inch, that 7 inches of satanic panic. That they put out.
Oh man. All right. Well, guys, I mean, if that's it, I'm going to go ahead and say adios.
Yeah, peace out.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com, type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.